Hi, it's David Locke, host of Locked On NBA, founder of the Locked On Podcast Network. Hope you got a chance to get ready for the NBA season with our incredible preview shows. Thanks to all the Locked On Podcast Network hosts who were so generous with their time to give you those previews. If you haven't heard them, Eastern Conference 1 and 2, Western Conference 1 and 2 are available on the Locked On NBA feed. This is an annual tradition that we love. Kevin Pelton, longtime friend, really one of my better friends, ESPN extraordinaire expert, joins us. As always, if you can thank him with an @KPelton tweet to say thank you for coming on, we greatly appreciate that when you do that for our guests. Today's show is brought to you, as always, by SeatGeek. Promo code LOCKED gets you $20 off. If you download the SeatGeek app and you make your first purchase, you'll get $20 back with a promo code LOCKED. DraftKings, also sponsoring today's show, and Bombfell as well. We'll tell you more about them, but let's get to Kevin and a really fun conversation about this NBA season.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
So the NBA did not help us with scheduling at all this year. The Jazz schedule sucks for all sorts of personal and real reasons, but maybe most of all because we usually played an NBA preseason game in Portland, which actually isn't the NBA, or a very early game in Portland, which allowed for two very important things to take place. One, for me to go to the Nike employee store and buy all my kids their presents, and two, to talk to Kevin Pelton and preview the NBA season. And we don't play in Portland till February 11th, so therefore, we're doing it over the phone. KP, it's the annual. Locke, Pelton, find something stupid to argue about, and go on long tirades and then diatribes and get lost along the way conversation. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little worried. I don't know if I have any material ready. Like, usually I like to have some sort of big picture of thought that I'm going to drop in during the podcast at somewhere, but hopefully it'll come to me as we're talking.
Well, I think the big picture thought is the fact that we have become, the NBA has become like the Bachelor or the Bachelorette. And the whole question is which pairs are going to, you know, be love and blissful, and which are going to fight in the middle of dinner.
I thought you were going to say, because we already know who one person is going to be in the final pair. Oh. We're just trying to figure. They're trying to narrow it down to the other person.
Fair enough. I think there's this tendency to not talk about the Warriors because they are so good. I'm just curious. Like, I think they're over-unders at like 68.5. I've gone over just because I don't think they can help it. What's your thought?
What's interesting because the statistical projections are generally much lower. Not in terms of the Warriors' ability relative to the rest of the league necessarily, but, you know, partially just by nature of being very conservative on the number of games they're going to win. So, you know, the 538 Carmelo projections have them at 63 wins. The RPM projections we did on ESPN, and which I'll update with, you know, kind of the final rosters and injuries during training camp that's coming out on Monday, have them between 62 and 63. So substantially below the line for them. It's interesting. I don't know. Do you see that both Steve Kerr and Bob Myers commented yesterday that they think that this is the best they've ever seen Steph Curry?
Yeah, I couldn't figure out whether that was true or, hey, the rest of the world's talking about Kevin Durant and our owner just made really stupid public comments about Steph Curry and how we didn't want to give him the max and we better do something fast to make sure that everyone realizes that we love Steph Curry.
Which also goes back to Kerr saying on Zach Lowe's podcast after the finals that, you know, Durant was in a different tier, I think, you know, basically than Curry in terms of the league's best players because of his size, which I wrote about at the time. But watching him last night in that preseason finale, he did look awfully good. I mean, the point that they make is, you know, his summer was spent rehabbing from the MCL injury that hampered him in the 2016 playoffs. This year, he had a full, healthy summer to actually, you know, work on his game and get prepared for the season. And I can see how that would make a difference. I also do not think there is any way he ever submits in 82 games anywhere close to what he did in 2015-16, because very few guys have ever done that in the history of the sport.
Okay, you just took the words right out of my mouth. That was exactly the next thing I was going to say is, wait a sec. I don't think he can be better. So I wasn't going to start here, but we'll go to it. You mentioned, and maybe you're not even totally prepared for this. You mentioned the real plus minus numbers and the Carmelo 538 numbers. Were there any big discrepancies in that? Is there anything that one system likes much more than the other?
There's a few teams. I'd say they're, you know, fairly similar. So the Carmelo, to explain it to people, uses both RPM and then box plus minus, which is the version that's similar to that. It tries to, you know, basically tries to predict adjusted plus minus using only box score stats. So it's a little more stable from year to year because it doesn't include that component of how the team performs on you with you on the court, adjusted for your teammates and the opponents who are out there. So they're very similar, but there are a couple of teams on which they notably differ. I think the most important one is probably Philadelphia, who RPM has around 33, 34 wins on average, and Carmelo has around 40, which would almost certainly be good enough for a playoff spot in the Eastern Conference.
So young, right? Like, I look at their depth chart, so young. Can that, you really make the playoffs that way?
I think you can. So, I mean, first off, it's the East, so the bar isn't as high as it is for those teams trying to do it in the Western Conference, as Jazz fans well know. I mean, another aspect of it is they're both. You remember when Nate McMillan used to talk about get it early or get it late as an offensive philosophy? The Sixers kind of have a roster like that because they've either got guys in their 30s or guys in their early 20s. There's not a lot of players right in their prime, but now they've got, you know, J.J. Redick, they've got Amir Johnson as, you know, some veteran leaders on this roster. Jared Bayless, who didn't play almost at all last season and now is back and I think, you know, has a pretty good chance to end up starting for them at point guard with Markel Fultz dealing with the shoulder and knee injuries. And if Fultz doesn't play, they're no longer quite as, you know, if he doesn't play as much, they're no longer quite as young in their starting lineup. It's just Simmons and Embiid. And Embiid, you know, whatever age, no matter how young he is, we know how dominant he is when he's on the court.
I feel like they're too, so I want to find the other Eastern Conference team so that I don't pick them in the playoffs. It makes me uncomfortable projecting them to win 10 more games and make the playoffs. But I have to find an alternative.
Yeah, I mean, Detroit is the team that RPM has eighth. 538, I think, actually has Indiana, or not Indiana, I should say Orlando ahead of Detroit, which I can envision how that would happen, but still would surprise me.
Detroit's a little interesting. I find Detroit, I don't like their bench much, but we're talking the East, so we can't get too picky. I think that, you know, if Reggie Jackson decides to not be cantankerous or cancerous, maybe it's got a chance. Stanley Johnson has not been good yet in his NBA career, and that draft class has not been either. That's always one of my theories on players like Stanley Johnson, that when they haven't, when everything hasn't started going great yet, that I like to look around them and see who in their draft class is standing around them. And if the other players are really good, then I figure he'll turn the corner. If they haven't, then I figure that there might be a problem. If I remember that draft class off the top of my head, Kaminsky, Justice Winslow are the next two in front of him. Moutier's around him. You do have Miles Turner, but so I don't know. Maybe Devin Booker. So maybe there's still a chance on Stanley Johnson. He might not fit that theory. Let's go to the Bachelorette game. So we have all these new pairings. Which of the new couples, and some of them are fairly, you know, we're in a modern, you know, era. Some of them are you know, tries, not just pairings. Which of them do you think is the best, is going to have the most harmonious 82-game journey?
All right, is there a third option besides Chris Paul and James Harden and then the OKC trio?
Sure, there's the I'll run down all of mine. I think there's the new partnership in Cleveland with Isaiah Thomas. I think there's the Boston group with Kyrie and Gordon. I think we should continue to discuss New Orleans, which would be the biggest, that trade deadline deal last year would be the biggest one we'd talk about if we hadn't just had the most insane offseason ever. There's the Houston triumphant. There's the OKC, you know, probably not appropriate to call it menage a trois, but, you know, or whatever you want to call it. So that's your threesome right there. So what do you – am I forgetting anybody else? Isn't that it?
That probably is it. I guess I would say Boston. I think has the best chance of being harmonious because, you know, I mean, Gordon Hayward, clearly when he signed there, I don't know that he expected Kyrie Irving to be there and, you know, his competition for being the guy, but Isaiah Thomas was in that role last season. So you had to expect that, you know, at that point, we didn't realize that he was going to miss as much time as it now looks like he will. You had to sort of expect that you were probably going there as a 1A, if not a number two, rather than being the number one guy. And I think, you know, then just the role players that they have around them, the offense that Brad Stevens has, I think has the best chance of keeping those guys happy. Beyond that, I mean, I think the interesting question to me here is, you know, it's easy for everyone to get along when things are going well. So if you're a team that everything clicks on the court and you win 60 games, you know, 55 to 60 games, let's take Houston, for example, then I don't think they're going to have an issue whatsoever. It's what happens if things don't go well, if you have a 3-game losing streak and then all of a sudden people start pointing fingers. So, you know, that's where it's almost impossible to predict because the fact is not necessarily just about the personalities of the players and the fit of them on the court. It's also about the situation they get placed in.
All right, so let me play devil's advocate, not because I actually totally believe this, but it just so I think Gordon Hayward can play with anyone and will be terrific with anyone. The only question I was reading, there was a Bleacher Report article on Gordon the other day, and Gordon in that article talks about how he and Kyrie have sat down to talk about how, you know, they're going to be 1A and 1A together and this. And I'm thinking to myself, like, I can see Gordon coming to Kyrie for this conversation. Well, I actually really can't because Gordon's not, doesn't talk that much, but so I could see, let's pretend they're having this conversation. I can see like the Kyrie Irving thought bubble. Like, are you beeping kidding me? I just left LeBron to be 1A. Like, I didn't leave LeBron to share. I asked out for LeBron because I want to prove who I am. And that, to me, was the – like, are you – like, Gordon Hayward, I'm not sharing with you. Is that an unfair thought to me to put that thought bubble on Kyrie Irving?
No, I mean, I think, you know, some of it depends on what – I don't know if we'll ever really understand what his motivations were for asking for the trades in Cleveland, if it really was the idea that, hey, LeBron's going to be gone in a year and I'm going to try and get out. Well, I still can. Then that probably sets up a different scenario for how he's going to feel about his time in Boston and if it truly is. And also if it's just like, I don't necessarily need to be the guy all by myself, but I need to be, have a larger share of things than I ever can in Cleveland because I'm always going to be the little brother to LeBron James. And well, Gordon, you know, we'll see how that shakes out in terms of who takes the lead role in terms of creating shots. You know, he's not going to be the little brother to Gordon Hayward in the same way that he was with LeBron.
So when you look at that trade between Boston and Cleveland, when it came out, I got to say, I thought Cleveland just got the best of the deal. And every day since, I've kind of veered back the other direction, right? So Isaiah Thomas doesn't play as much. The way things have kind of broken out, Brooklyn's not going to be as bad as I think people thought they were going to be, that picks. So in all that regard, the one thing that I still wonder in regards to Boston is just the amount of roster turnover and who they were as a team a year ago or the last 2 years to me was this relentless, defensive pain in the ass. You knew they were going to be up on you all game. You knew it was going to be hard. You knew they were going to be, you know, Marcus Smart and Avery Bradley and Jay Crowder and Amir Johnson and Kelly Olynyk and Jonas Derebko were going to at least get you with one or two elbows during the game. And you just kind of knew that you were going to be beaten up like by a battering ram of defense. Who do you think they are now?
I don't know that they necessarily have to give up that identity. I mean, a lot of it's going to depend on Jaylen Brown's ability to grow into that, you know, wing stopper role for them, assuming that he starts in the other spot as he has been throughout all the preseason alongside Hayward and that, you know, Smart comes off the bench, which seems like the role they're more comfortable having him in. You know, if he can really embrace defense and physical defense, then, you know, you've also got Aaron Baines you brought in who's in some ways a more physical player than, you know, some of the front court guys they lost, Amir Johnson and Kelly Olynyk. So I don't think they necessarily have to give that up. To me, it's all a lot about, you know, so much of their identity the last couple of years was built on we're the underdogs. We were guys who were, you know, if we were drafted in the first round, it was late in the first round, but probably we were drafted in the second round. And we've got this coach who finally believes in us and is putting us in the right spot to succeed, and we're going to do everything we can to reward him. Now you've got all these guys who were lottery picks, all in the top 10 as the core of your team. And that is, I think, substantially different, you know, for a coach who has preached the concept of grit in the Angela Duckworth sense of the term, where it's about, you know, overcoming adversity and you know, continuing to work towards a long-term goal. Like that means something different to guys that had to fight their way into the league as opposed to players who were anointed at a young age.
I do think it'll be interesting. Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, you know, the somebody said to me once, it was one of the great kind of comments ever, don't ever forget that every player in this league is going interested in establishing their own personal value first and the team next. And that's, and they just looked at me and they were like, don't ever doubt it. Don't ever be lured up to believe otherwise. Every player ever will worry about their own personal value first and the team second. And until they've established their own personal value, that's the priority. And so they do, as you're saying, have these big draft picks who have great visions of what their personal value is.
Yeah, and, you know, that's an aspect of the Celtics, that they're, as much as we talk about the Sixers being young, like, they're not young like the Sixers because their best players are in the prime of their career, but they're relying a lot on Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum because of that trade, because of giving up Jay Crowder, which I wrote about that trade in ESPN, the magazine, in some depth. I don't know if that's on newsstands yet, but it should be out shortly if it's not out there yet.
Or on Texture.
Yes.
Texture will work. Another thing that will work, and Kevin, you might want to be a part of this, is have you heard of BombFell? BombFell. It is an easier way for men to get better clothes. It's really, really cool. I mean, I am not a shopper. I don't know name brands. I don't know any of this stuff. You guys have seen that. It's not good for me. So BombFell is an easier way for men to get better clothes in a very personalized manner. It's really easy. So you set up your account at BombFell. You give them your budget limits and everything. And then they attach you to a stylist. And the stylist sends you the things. And frankly, the first thing they sent me, I didn't like. And so I went back and said, actually, I don't like this. I don't like this. I don't like this. And now I'm screwing it up because I don't have enough guts. Like, you probably would have more guts to do something with this. And then they sent me back, and I got this really cool pair of jeans. I think Mavi or something like that. And then this maroon T-shirt that's awesome and this great button-down shirt. And I received that all within 7 days of it. I could have sent it back, but I knew I liked it because the personalized stylist picked it out for me. It's BombFell. All right, so you sign up. You tell them about yourself, give them your measurements, your style preferences. Then they tell you, they set up an order and they find out what you want. And then you get a preview email. And that's where the stylist kicks in. And in that preview email is where I said, I don't really like this. I changed it, got stuff I liked better. Then they shipped it. I received the clothes. And in 7 days, I could have returned it, but I didn't because I kept all of it. I loved it. It's absolutely fabulous. It's flexible. You can receive the clothes when you want. You can pause or cancel at any time. So really a fabulous experience. I loved it. You can get $25 off your first BombFell at BombFell.com/LONBA. We negotiated this deal for you so you get a great offer. BombFell.com/LONBA. Check it out. I really think, guys, you're going to find this easy. You're going to find it awesome and you're going to be impressed. Kevin, it's not a bad idea for you, but let's go back to talking NBA. So let's stay east just because we're there, and we'll go back to our Bachelorette theme, or probably just our Bachelorette theme. I never watched that show. I don't really know how it works. do you believe either that Boston is better than Cleveland, if you think this is harmonious, or do you believe this other side, that they still have enough youth and something that somebody else actually might catch Boston? And more so, what's your feeling?
Well, the statistical projections, again, seem to very clearly say that the latter is more likely. I mean, RPM has Boston in the pack in the Eastern Conference and below on average, both Milwaukee, who is the interesting wild card here, and Washington. So, yeah, I mean, I feel better about the Celtics than those projections. They've looked very cohesive offensively in the preseason, given the turnover that they've had. I mean, I still, you know, I would pick them second in the West, in the Eastern Conference behind Cleveland. But, you know, as long as Isaiah Thomas is back in by the playoffs, I think Cleveland is still the best team in the conference. And then I think Milwaukee and Washington are those two teams that really have a chance to, you know, if things don't go well in Cleveland with this, you know, new mix of players, and in Boston the same thing where there are some red flags, then, you know, maybe there's an outside chance at, you know, an Atlanta 2014 scenario where this team we never thought of as a number one seed ends up in that role.
So you mentioned Milwaukee. I didn't get this all the way done, but I was running some of my PAC numbers, and I know you aren't the great, hugest believer in PAC, but I believe in it. And actually last year offensively, it turned out to have a pretty good indicator. It's got no defensive indicator at all. I'm openly about that. But I was interested how well Milwaukee's offense, which I think is not that good, suddenly comes out. That you look at them, and the only below-average offensive players they had last year were Teletovic and Dellavedova. And I think there's an argument that each of their minutes could be down a good deal in this upcoming season. And suddenly, when they – and Giannis is great, and then everybody else is just a little bit above average, you become a pretty good offensive team, and we – other than Jason Kidd's strange style of allowing a million corner threes, they're okay defensively. Do you buy this idea that Milwaukee has got a chance to jump up and into this top four of the Eastern Conference?
I mean, I think they have a high degree of variability in their outcome. I think really everyone except maybe Cleveland in the middle of the East Pack does. In Washington's case, it's really injuries because of the fact that they're so reliant on their core, their starters, and then, you know, their three to four best players. And in Milwaukee's case, it's that, you know, they've been so wildly up and down the last few years. I mean, 2 years ago, when they had just signed Greg Monroe, we thought that, you know, they were coming off. It was a similar position to where they are now, where they were coming off this unexpectedly good season, run to the playoffs, gave Chicago a run in the first round, much as they did last year with Toronto, and okay, now they're going to take the next step, and instead they went backwards by like 20 games. So, you know, I'm a little wary of them from that standpoint, but I think they do have a mix that could be really interesting because, you know, Chris Middleton, people forget how important a part of that team he was. And they got him, getting him back midseason helped them be a better team despite losing Jabari Parker to the torn ACL at almost exactly the same time that they got Middleton back. So now you get a full season of healthy Chris Middleton, and that I think makes them a much more dangerous offensive team.
All right, what else if I told you I thought Toronto was going to be the number one seed?
It goes against what the statistical projections say about Toronto, which is that they're likely to regress this year. But they have on their side the continuity of the fact that, you know, they've worked in Serge Ibaka. It's not exactly the same group, but the main three guys, they've also C.J. Miles, who is only
Haven't talked about C.J. Miles compared to Damari Carroll. Like, that's a huge upgrade.
I think Damari Carroll was better than people thought. I actually think he's going to have a really nice season for Brooklyn, that they gave up way too much to get off his contract.
Really? You and I really disagree on this one.
Yeah. My bold prediction is that Brooklyn will end up trading Damari Carroll for something of value by the end of his contract. Like, someone will want to have him on an expiring contract as a role player.
C.J. Miles was really good last year.
I like C.J. Miles. I think that was the one reason I felt better about them trading so much to get off of Carroll, is because of the fact that they were able to sign C.J. Miles. I mean, you know, but the difference is he's not the same kind of physical defender against the bigger threes. That's where I think they're going to miss Carroll. And then they don't really have someone who ideally slides down from the three to the four. Like, that was Carroll's role. I mean, Indiana tried that with C.J. Miles. It actually worked okay, but then he got beaten up physically and was never the same player the rest of that season. The year that they were nominally starting Paul George at the four, but it was really Miles who was defending those guys. And then, you know, Norman Powell is tough and as physical as he is and strong. I mean, you can't ask him to defend, you know, the bigger threes, combo 3-4s. He's like 6'5".
Interesting. I don't know. I just feel like that starting five of Toronto is really, really good. I like the CJ, just to explain myself so people don't think I'm crazy. And then I kind of think this whole idea, this second unit of all of their young kids, give them a lineup that, while they are aging, gives them a little bit of a different feel in different aspects of the game. And I I like the way that thing looks right now, particularly because I'm not sure my games I really think Cleveland's going to win. I kind of feel what we talked about with Boston, the Morris injury in Washington, which I think that – I actually think the East is just open, and I don't know. All right, we can move past that. Houston, when I ran my numbers, I was stunned at how close they are to Golden State offensively with the numbers I ran. I think this bachelor-bachelorette pairing is going to be fabulous.
And it's interesting because when we talk about, you know, is this going to work? I don't think there's any question of whether it's going to work on the court. Like, they're both good off-ball shooters. They can both spot up. You can play one of those guys. You know, I have at least one of those guys on the court for all 48 minutes, which is an incredible luxury and something that I can't remember who wrote the piecemeal on that. I think it was Jonathan Charks on The Ringer this week about that. I can't remember if it was him or O'Connor, but pointed out that, you know, historically, D'Antoni's teams have had this huge drop-off offensively whenever their star point guard has been on the bench, which is understandable. And all of a sudden, if you take that out of the equation, then, you know, the case they made was that they've got a chance to be the best offensive team in NBA history, which, you know, first, you got to be the best team in the league this year, I guess, but
right.
It's not inconceivable.
No, I was stunned. I mean, the Warriors' pack rating is, like, you know, dramatically better than anyone else in the league by huge amounts. And the Rockets is right next to them, like right next to them. There's not even the next closest team, I think, was the Clippers. Like, it's not even close how good they might be.
The interesting thing is the RPM projection for them, even though it has them as the second best team, it's actually much more about how much RPM likes to, you know, rates them well defensively.
Whoa.
Even more than their offense, which is projected fifth in the league.
Who's your top? What's your top five offensive projections?
Number one is obviously Golden State. Number two is Minnesota. Number three is Cleveland. And number four is Oklahoma City.
So I think Oklahoma – I have Minnesota having home court advantage in the first round. But any concern on just the lack of spacing there?
Sure.
Well, that loquacious answer by you, Kevin. Let me turn the focus over to DraftKings. Hoop fans, we know basketball season's back. And now you can put your basketball knowledge you're getting from Kevin to the test with the one-day fantasy basketball at DraftKings.com. One-day fantasy basketball at DraftKings. You can be a part of the action every night. DraftKings, there are so many ways to play. Choose between public contests with big cash, private contests where you can take on your friends. DraftKings even has beginner and casual contests where you'll play against people of similar skill level, but none of you are beginners. DraftKings, your team is simple. You just select eight players, stay under your $50,000 salary cap, scoring, assists, blocks, rebounds, and more. And the best part is you get a draft, a new team, every day without any commitment. There's no better way to turn your love of basketball into cash tonight with DraftKings one-day fantasy basketball. So go to DraftKings.com. Use the code DRIBBLE to play free with your first deposit for your share of $10,000 in total prizes. It is DRIBBLE. That's the code DRIBBLE to play for free with your first deposit only at DraftKings. The game inside the game. Minimum $5 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. Okay. I mean, it's just, right, everything we're talking about. All right, let me go back to a point you had a minute ago, because I actually think you just got to something that's maybe the biggest story of the offseason. So the Rockets, you mentioned it last year, when Harden was off the court, they were terrible.
Yep.
When the Thunder, when Russell Westbrook was off the floor, were -9 per 100 possessions, and +3. Mm-hmm. And the Rockets, I think it was similar with Harden. I could pull up the exact number if you give me, you know, 3 seconds of babbling about how I'm going to pull up the number, then hopefully it'll come up in that time period. But to me, that's the biggest story of this offseason, is here were these two teams that had these incredible problems with their primary guy went off the floor, and both of them should be rectified. Harden, actually, they were still positive. It was just a 4-point differential.
And 7 points worth offensively. That was Kevin O'Connor's piece this week on the
okay.
Winger, by the way, to right. Give him credit. Yeah, I mean, that's a huge thing. I mean, because, you know, the interesting thing about last year is what made the MVP race interesting is you had all of these lone wolves. Harden in Houston, Westbrook in Oklahoma City, Kawhi to some extent in San Antonio, although the team actually didn't play that much worse with him on the bench because of some defensive weirdness that we can get into. This year, now all of a sudden, it's just Kawhi of those three because the other two, you've added Hall of Famers to go with them. And, you know, I think that assuming those rotations work out correctly, yeah, you shouldn't have anything near that kind of drop-off, and that could help both teams considerably.
Oklahoma City. The addition of Paul George I thought was great. I thought they had a defensive lineup that could have made them the best defensive team in the league. I thought that you could play Paul George without Russell Westbrook and deal with what we just talked about. And I was close to putting Oklahoma City second in the West. And then they acquired Carmelo Anthony. And now I might put him sixth. Am I crazy?
I mean, I don't think you're crazy. It's interesting. Zach Lowe said something similar this week on the Lowe Post in terms of, you know, how he was looking at them for a second until they made the Carmelo Anthony trade. I mean, I think the good thing about the Melo trade is, to me, it makes them more volatile. And as Daryl Morey would tell us, if you're trying to beat the Warriors, if you're trying to beat the dominant team, then you want risk. You want volatility because just being at the middle of your expectation, that ain't going to be good enough. You have to hit the absolute top of your expectation. So the higher your top is, the better. And I do think Melo gives them more upside in terms of, you know, they're going to play more small ball, which I think will be advantageous for them in matching up with both Golden State and Houston in the playoffs. And if Melo can accept a role where he's primarily spotting up as opposed to creating his own offense, at least when he's playing with Westbrook and George, with all three of those guys on the court, you know, he could become a lot more efficient. I mean, I think the Olympic Melo thing is a little overstated just because of the fact that he was also benefiting from the shorter three-point line. And historically, Melo has been much better from around 20 feet than he has from the three-point line. But he also has been a much better shooter in terms of catch-and-shoot situations from the three-point line than when he's pulling up. So if you take those pull-ups out of his game and replace them with, you know, catch-and-shoot threes, then he becomes substantially more efficient in a hurry.
All right, so we'll get back to our pairs. There's three players that switched teams this year that everyone seems to be excited about, and my numbers tell you the exact opposite on all three of them. So you're going to tell me why I'm wrong, because that's what you always do. I'm glad to know that I'm secure enough in myself that I just concede this right to you to tell me how off I am. The first one's Carmelo. Carmelo, in my pack ratings in 13-14, was still a really good player. And then in 14-15, he suddenly became average. And then in 15-16, he suddenly slipped considerably, and he stopped going to the line as much. And then in 16-17, he was even worse. He was a minus 0.7, which means, for those who don't follow my pack, with the 20 scoring opportunities he takes every night, an average player would score 0.7 points more than he does. Okay. Paul Millsap is the same story. Paul Millsap is 30-whatever years old and is on a tremendous decline. A lot of people can try to tell me, well, it's because Dwight Howard screwed it all up. And then the third one is that Dwayne Wade was maybe the worst offensive player in all the NBA last year, or at least had the biggest negative impact of any player in the league. And yet I'm listening all the time about how these three players are changing where, you know, that Wade to Cleveland pushes them over the top. And by the way, just to be clear on this, I over-exaggerated Wade. Justice Winslow, who only played 18 games, was worse. Zach Randolph was less good, who played 73 games. Nikolai Vukovic was less good, who played 75 games. And Dwayne Wade was of players who played at least 60 games, which Wade did last year, he was the third most negatively impactful offensive player in the game last year.
I mean, it still doesn't sound like a guy you want to start over J.R. Smith. Particularly, I mean, Wade is probably the one of these three I agree with you about the most. I mean, the question is, you know, can he go back to what he was in Miami in terms of compensating for his lack of three-point shooting to create floor spacing because of the fact that he's just such a dangerous threat as a cutter? And I don't know. I don't know how much of that was, you know, his his athleticism at that point, the fact that he was still this otherworldly athlete, that now, you know, he might have, you know, back then he might have had 5 or 6 of those plays a night. Maybe now he has 1 or 2, maybe 2 or 3 on a good night. And he did look pretty good. I was watching him in the preseason last night. Yeah, he had some good moments for them, though.
You are so desperate for data that you're watching preseason games to make observations.
Well, yeah. So you got to be avoid falling into the what you see is all there is trap, but it is useful to figure out how these guys are going to play, if not how well. You know, so if he can do that, he can still be a helpful player. I think that he inhibits the Cavaliers in the playoffs much more than he helps them, and I think they're worse off for having signed him because of the fact that they're going to play him so much over guys who are better shooters. I do feel a little better about the fact that, you know, they're not playing him over Jay Crowder, who is going to start at power forward, but this shift of Kevin Love to center, which I think is a really fascinating experiment. Millsap, I don't necessarily disagree with you offensively. I do think that I don't want to say Dwight Howard screwed him up, because I don't think that's fair. One thing that happened 2 years ago is because of the fact that Al Horford became such a 3-point threat, a lot of teams had to invert their matchups against the Hawks. So they would put their power forward on Horford to deal with his pick and pop, and then stick their center on Millsap, and then Millsap's able to drive that guy and beat him off the dribble and create trouble that way. Now, Nikola Jokic is enough of a playmaker from the high post that I think there's some scenarios where he might see that this year. But the real reason I'm excited about Paul Millsap to Denver is not offensively, where, you know, he'll be fine. He's not going to be a downgrade over trying to play Mason Plumlee with Jokic. But it's really about the defensive end of the court, where he has not shown any signs of slippage. Was, in my mind, a legitimate candidate for a spot on the defensive player of the year ballot, not for the actual award, because Gobert and Draymond Green were miles ahead of anybody else for the actual award. But, you know, that was one of the best defenses in the league last year, and I think he probably deserves a great deal of the credit for that. It's a power forward. And then to put Melo, I mean, I don't totally disagree with you. I mean, I'm the person who's been out there beating the drum that ESPN NBA rank putting Melo 64th was not only fair, but perhaps even a little bit generous, all things considered, given his performance in recent years. I do think that looking at pack rating, you know, again, it doesn't take into account your role in the offense. And if he slides from being someone who primarily creates his own shot, to especially in isolation, to someone who is playing off of Russell Westbrook and hopefully playing off of Paul George and not taking all those possessions away from him, that he will be much more efficient in Oklahoma City.
If you're going to go see any of these incredible players this year, then make sure you do it by getting your tickets through SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the easiest way for you to get tickets to any upcoming game, concert, football game, college football game, or theater event that's going on. Here's how you do it. You download the SeatGeek app right to your phone. Then go to the settings tab, enter in the promo code LOCKED, and you're going to get $20 back on your first purchase. Now you go to whichever event you're interested in. They show you all of the tickets from all of the different people all around the area, so you don't have to search anywhere else. They give each ticket a ticket score. That allows you to know, if you don't know the arena or the theater or the stadium, to know which are the best values out there. And then when you buy them, it's secured and it's on your phone. It's that easy. It's why I use SeatGeek, why you should too. It's the easiest way out there for you to get tickets. Download the SeatGeek app. Go to the settings tab, enter in the promo code LOCKED. You get $20 back on your first rebate. You can also set price alerts to upcoming events. It's all on the app SeatGeek.
It's interesting. I was listening to a podcast somewhere. Gosh darn it. I hate it when I do this. I don't remember, because I hate it when I think someone's talking about me and then they don't say it. And I always think it's conscious, and this one is just not conscious. I was walking in Phoenix. I'm trying to remember. Well, let's give Ben Golliver a shout out. I don't think it was him, but he's a great dude. Might as well give him a show. Let's say I was listening to Open Floor. I have no idea. But the conversation was how it was obvious to them that Paul George was the one that was going to have to take the Chris Bosh role here. And I was just like listening, like, oh my gosh, no, it's the exact opposite. Like, Paul George should be taking the LeBron role, Russell Westbrook should be taking the Wade role, and Carmelo should be taking the Chris Bosh role. And I actually think that there's a decent chance Westbrook will still take the lead role, but that that'll be inverted to some extent in Oakland. It's why I think Oklahoma City is really going to struggle. I just think they're not going to be nearly as good as everyone thinks they're going to be offensively. And then what they were going to be great at defensively is gone because of Carmelo.
I don't know. Is Melo that bad a defender? I mean, is a power forward? You're going to have to switch everything, which that's kind of, you know, Knicks coaches spent years getting blamed for how much they switched everything. And it turned out it was actually just because Melo didn't want to do the hard work of fighting over screen. But, you know, that matchup won't be great, but Westbrook switching on a power forward isn't the worst thing in the world. And I don't know, the one thing that worries me about them defensively is the Thunder organization really just, like, emphatically believes that Andre Robertson is better off defending wings than he or even guards than he is defending bigs. And if they just played Andre Robertson defensively as the power forward, I think they'd be fine. I mean, and just let Melo take whoever the weakest offensive player is and stay out of the way for the most part. I mean, is Melo a worse defender than Ryan Anderson in Houston? Like, Houston's wasn't that much worse defensively last year than Oklahoma City was, were they?
Oklahoma City last year defensively was 10th in the league. Rockets were 18th.
Houston was a little, 18th.
Yeah. Staying on defensive ratings for a second, because I think this is an interesting conversation. You mentioned Millsap's impact in Denver, Thibodeau and Taj Gibson's impact in Minnesota. What is the Jimmy Butler? What is the historical? If you have it, like, Minnesota was 26th in the league defensively, Denver was 29th. Like, how far can they go? Like, I just don't – I kind of have this feeling, like, you don't go from 26th to 15th, do you?
Well, I mean, Houston last year was a good example of that, weren't they?
They went from what? They were 18th last year, and they what were they the year before?
Worse than 18th. I don't know off the top of my head where they were 2 years ago, but I know it was worse
than
that.
They were 21st the year before.
Yeah, okay.
I really think this is the one area where everyone's talking about I'm pretty high on Minnesota, but I just think this is one area, and I understand it, because when we analyze teams, we look at offense, and that's the easy one to always look at, and I got it, and it's really important. If you're tied at 92 with 4 minutes left, you got to score to win. But I do think we're asking –
I don't think it has anything to do with that, actually.
I think we're asking –
People put that forward as an explanation. I don't think offensive teams actually do any better in close games than defensive teams.
Really?
Yeah, I don't buy that part.
Oh, that's interesting. I totally buy that. Just the wow, that's really interesting. Is that just because every coach is so uncomfortable if they don't know how to score? And so every coach just goes offensive late in games?
Yeah, I think individual offense becomes more important, but you know, there's just not a lot of evidence. Someone asked me this question a few weeks ago, and I looked at it in my mailbag, and there wasn't any evidence that offensive teams do better in close games than defensive teams do. It's mostly random is the answer. It's mostly random.
So Minnesota
got a point and a half better per 100 possessions last year defensively. I mean, I think that's realistic for Denver and Minnesota.
All right, so if they get a point and a half better, which is a big jump, right? Like that. Like, make sure you explain to me. Let's say I'm listening right now or hosting right now and don't really understand what a point and a half is. Is that big? Is that – like, how big is a point and a half?
Well, I mean, it's all subjective. But, you know, here's what I would say is last year Minnesota was minus 1 point per 100 possession. They had a much better, you know, point differential, efficiency differential than they did record. So you – get a point and a half better per 100 possessions, even if they don't get any better on offense with the addition of Jimmy Butler, that makes them an above 500 team all of a sudden.
Right. And I actually guess I'm pushing them toward almost, you know, battling for home court, which I think they probably can do. But it's interesting. Like, so if Denver goes a point and a half, Denver still finishes 26th in the league defensively.
but they're plus, now they're plus almost one per 100 possessions. And then that's, we're also looking at, you know, their offensive rating of the whole season. Whereas if you look at just after Jokic took over as the starting center, they were, you know, better than anyone.
All right, let's play the reverse. Let's play the good defensive team, the bad offensive team. So Utah's a 102.7 defensively last year. Arguably a better defensive roster this year than last year, but let's just hold it at 102.7. Are they 5 points worse offensively without Gordon Hayward and George Hill?
Probably not.
I mean, they would have to go from 107.4 to 102.7, which would make them the fifth worst offense in the NBA to be 500. Is that where they are?
I think that you probably should project some just regression in the mean, just because of the fact that, you know, when you're, so RPM has them at 104 on offense, 102.4 on defense.
And so and winning how many games then?
Well, which I guess is better. And then about 44 when you factor in the schedule.
So the interesting one to me on Utah is the two things that they have, and you'll actually quibble with one of these, which will be interesting, is one is just kind of to our point, the value of defense over the value of offense, right? Like we look at Jokic and Gary Harris and the addition of Paul Millsap, and you're like, that team's going to be awesome offensively. And I mean, I love Minnesota because I think Karl Anthony Towns is going to be MVP candidate because it's just time. He's just that great. He could score 30 every night if he needed to. I'm convinced of it. He's just so terrific. And, you know, you look at them and they can score. And then you look at Utah, who defends equally as well as both of those teams play offense. So it gets like, what is the value of defense in contrast of a great defense in the value of a contrast to a great offense?
So it's generally not quite as high because of the fact that there's, you know, we usually look at it in terms of rankings rather than distance from average. And there's usually more spread in teams offensively than there is defensively. So the best teams are far better relative to average on offense than on defense. And the worst teams are worse relative to average on offense than defense. So if you've got a team that's 25th in offense and 5th in defense, and a team that's 5th in offense and 25th in defense, odds are the team that's 5th in offense and 25th in defense will win slightly more games.
1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7. Like what's slightly?
1 to 2, probably okay. In that range.
What is the value of depth? Now, you don't think Utah actually has very good depth.
I mean, it's one of the surprising results in the ESPN preview we did. You know, it goes through every team in terms of the projected RPM of their, you know, starters at each of the five positions and then the bench. And Utah actually comes out, you know, the weakest, I think, possibly of all those spots for them is the bench because of the fact that, first off, Donovan Mitchell's rating as a rookie who was not all that efficient offensively in college is really poor, and I think much worse than most people are expecting, you know, if they think about what Donovan Mitchell is going to do this season. And then, let's see, who's the other factor in this besides Donovan Mitchell?
Probably Alec Burks isn't very good.
No, although he's not projected to play all that many minutes. The way I have it set up right now.
He is now.
Udo is the other guy, which I don't particularly believe it. Udo comes out poorly based on his, because of the fact that the best way to predict a defense for players is just to assume that everyone is going to be replacement level on defense, and Udo was going to be much better than replacement level on defense. So that one is wrong. That's just a bad estimate.
So what is the value of depth? Let's assume that a team has good depth. Like, what's that value? What's the value of roster spots 7 through 12?
Well, I mean, I think the one question we're going to find out is, will that change this year because of the fact that you've got one fewer timeout per game that's contrasted with the fact that now you've got more rest between games. So I don't know. I don't know where that's going to go this year.
The timeout thing, by the way, one is an announcer and two is just analyzing the game, I think is mammoth. It's not been talked about. I haven't seen many articles written about it. I think it's mammoth. I think if coaches are not practicing for it right now, they're going to be stunned and they're going to spend the entire first 2 weeks in their few practices practicing for it. It's a huge impact.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the one thing is you don't have, even though there are fewer stoppages, you don't have the long period without a stoppage in the first and third quarters because now that timeout comes a little earlier.
Yeah, I think the timeout game is a different game. In fact, I think coaches...
Your guy gets the chance to play his trick of make the other team play 10 minutes at altitude by calling a timeout
right.
early in the quarter in four different quarters.
Right. No, if I'm Quinn Snyder and we're at home, I'm calling a timeout 30 seconds into every quarter and looking like I'm yelling at my players.
Why is this guy so angry?
And really, all you're doing is saying, okay, by the way, our next timeout's under three. Let's go. Here's altitude. Let's go. Mike Malone should do it in Denver, too. He's got depth. The other one is the only two timeouts in the final 3 minutes means that the timeout that coaches used to call to kind of go get that two for one with like 45 seconds left so they could execute that perfectly and then get their two for one, you either now call that timeout and concede that you have no more left the rest of the way in all likelihood, or you don't call that timeout anymore because you're saving your final timeout to move the advance the ball in the final portion of the game. And I might argue the first one's more valuable than the second one. The second one gives coaches security, but I think the first one's more valuable.
That's interesting. The value of timeouts, you know, I'd like to study more.
The other one, at some point, the way the timeouts work, because if two timeouts are called by the same coach, they're both of them classified as mandatories, and you just means you go to the fourth quarter with only three, but you can't carry more than four in anyway. So you're actually, if you call two timeouts in a quarter as the same coach, you're actually forcing them to go use a timeout or lose it. The other one is
right.
I think as a coach, you should always enter the fourth quarter with only three timeouts because you're going to lose that extra timeout anyway at the 3 minute mark.
So then you should use it to set up the play at the end of the quarter.
At some point, yeah. You can if you don't use any timeouts extra, you go to the fourth quarter, the four timeouts, that's the max you can take. At the 3 minute mark, it drops to two. So the mandatory is going to get you for one, and then you're going to use that. You have to use that one other timeout somewhere between the beginning of the fourth quarter and the 3 minute mark, or you lose it. Well, you might as well use it earlier in the game at some point where it deems important to you, whether it's controlling the game, whether it's Rick Carlisle making sure you get your play exactly as you want, whatever it is, you should use it earlier.
No, I'm still laughing at Rick Carlisle's line about you never run out of timeouts.
You just get technical fouls.
Yep.
I like that. All right, final thing for you. Oh, wait, I had one thing on my notes I really, really did want to talk about. DeMarcus and Anthony Davis, you were very positive about it when the trade happened. They had to try to do it on the fly for a short period of time. It didn't really work. It screwed up Drew Holiday badly. What is your thought on this now? I mean, this is so funny to me. This is like a non-story because this is one of the craziest stories ever. We just have had so much stuff happen, we don't care about it anymore. So what is your thought on DeMarcus and Anthony Davis?
Well, it's also the one that probably has the most impact going forward because if New Orleans is out of the playoff race and it's looking like, you know, it's not working, then Cousins probably becomes the biggest player available at the trade deadline for the second consecutive year. So it'll come back. It's interesting. They're not a team I've seen a lot of in the preseason. I caught a bit of their game last night, but I didn't see Cousins and Davis playing together almost at all. Watching some of the clips, I saw a series of clips early in the preseason about how they're bringing these guys off screens, using them essentially almost as guards, which is quite fascinating to me. It does seem like they have just given up on Drew Holiday trying to really be a pick-and-roll ball handler, and he's just going to be around for his spacing, which I don't know why you would pay him $20 million a year if that's what you were doing with him. But I don't know. I mean, I feel less good about them, I would say, than the projections, which have them, you know, right in the mix. You know, basically Utah, Portland, and New Orleans are all very close for that. Well, I guess Utah comes out much better than the Carmelo projections, but Portland and New Orleans both very close in most of the projection systems.
All right, final two questions for you. A few years ago, you had the Knicks as your team that you said were going to be terrible. You were right, despite being, you know, panned badly in the New York Post. I don't think you've ever reached out to them to point out you were right, but you should have. Do you have that team this year that is going to be considerably less good than what you thought it was going to be? Where you're different than everybody else. Sorry, I guess.
Right. If you're going by them, you'd say Boston. I don't know if there's anyone I feel strongly about that they're. I mean, you know, Philly is compared to like their over under. I think that's really optimistic, but there's no one that I think that everyone's completely missing the boat on.
Anybody you think is going to be much better than people realize?
I mean, part of it, I think, is now that some of, you know, these projections get baked into the conventional wisdom a little bit more than they used to. And I think, you know, Milwaukee, like I said, has a chance to be substantially better. I think people who, the Clippers, actually, are maybe the interesting one that we haven't talked about at all. Because that's another very different mix and a team with a lot of volatility when you look at the injury history of Danilo Gallinari and Blake Griffin and maybe throw Patrick Beverley in that mix. They're a team that looks really deep this year that has not had depth ever before in the past. They've got, you know, a lot of really interesting players, and all of the statistical projections are quite high on them, I would say, like closer to 50 wins than 40 wins. And that's a team that, you know, we were talking earlier about Ben Golliver's predictions. He doesn't have them in the playoffs in the Western Conference.
I have them as fifth.
Yeah, so you have them ahead of Oklahoma City, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's going too far, but I think fifth is possible. I think I would consider them more likely if they get there to pass Minnesota of the teams that are conventionally considered the top five in the West. But yeah, they've looked pretty good to me, I think, so far in the preseason when they've actually been playing their guys. Tate Osich is going to be incredibly fun to watch if a turnstile defensively. They've got a lot of interesting pieces, so we'll see what Doc Rivers is able to do with them.
Who is the player that we will think of differently at this time next year?
I mean, it seems like maybe the reclamation has already started, but, you know, I think D'Angelo Russell has a really good shot at it if he takes to that Brooklyn system, which should be very favorable for him playing well alongside Jeremy Lin. And the thing I've noticed, and this is too small a sample size to really read anything into, but he's made a couple pull-up threes when I've watched him in the preseason. And that was the big thing he struggled with last year. And as I wrote about last year in the playoffs, that's really become the differentiator for the good point guards in this league, is their ability to make you have to come over the screen to defend them, because if you go under, they will make a pull-up three. And last year, Russell was a pretty good catch-and-shoot three-point shooter, but struggled with the three off the dribble.
Very interesting stuff, Kevin Pelton. You do great work. Continued success. You're big time. I will see you in February unless you decide to come out and visit us sooner.
That would be fun, but I don't know if I'll make it out, so let's plan on February.
All right. He is Kevin Pelton, ESPN. What else, by the way, what should they be clicking on for you?
Well, an exciting announcement coming soon, I think, on some new podcasting opportunities at ESPN, and then the RPM, final RPM projections on ESPN Insider Monday.
All right, just go click on the RPM and ignore the podcasting stuff. You know, that's pure competition. See you, buddy. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much to Kevin. He's one of my favorites. If you could send him an @KPelton, thank you. We'd greatly appreciate it. And make sure you subscribe to your favorite NBA team's daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Thanks very much for tuning in. This has been Locked On NBA.